It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we continue our week-long series on literacy here in Wisconsin. First, a look at a bill that passed last week in the State Assembly. It was sent to the Joint Finance Committee by the Senate today. The bill aims to increase compensation for people who were wrongfully convicted of a crime. It passed the Assembly unanimously. People advocating for those that have been wrongly convicted see it as a big step in the right direction. There has been some concern, though, that some of the bill's provisions could hinder access to public information. Here to tell us more is Shireen Seward, news editor of the City Pages in Wausau. She previously reported on compensation for exonerees with Gannett, Wisconsin Media's investigative team. Shireen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, paint us a picture here. How has our compensation here in Wisconsin for people who have been wrongfully convicted, how does that compare to federal guidelines and other states?
Well, we're one of the worst in the nation. Wisconsin exonerees are entitled to only a fraction of the amount of that federal levels require. So in 2004, Congress proposed a standard compensation recommendation of $50,000 a year for every year spent behind bars. And in states where there is a death penalty, $100,000 a year for time spent on death row. Now, that proposal is active, or it did pass for federal crimes. But in Wisconsin, compensation is capped at $5,000 a year for up to 5 years. So the most they can get is $25,000. So it's very, very small.
And you've reported on this. There have been exonerees who had been in prison for upwards of 20 years. And then that cap of $25,000 a year looks pretty small.
It absolutely does. And complicating that is the fact that it's very difficult for those exonerees to get that compensation. The bar is set so high, and this bill that's been proposed would change that.
Yes, let's get into this bill now. First of all, raising that cap to that level you mentioned, $50,000 a year, how would it be streamlined? How would it be easier for someone who's been exonerated, they're out of prison now, how easy would it be for them to try to get that compensation?
It still wouldn't be easy, but right now in Wisconsin, defendants have to prove their innocence by clear and convincing evidence, and that's usually something like DNA, something that's very clear. But that's not really one of the main causes of wrongful convictions. Eyewitness misidentification is the first. Then we have improper forensics, false confessions, which actually account for nearly 30% of them, and then informants giving false testimony. So this changes that because the new bill would act on a preponderance of evidence. That's a lesser standard, so it would be easier for exonerees to meet that particular level.
This passed the Assembly unanimously. That doesn't happen often, except for maybe, I don't know, Puppy Appreciation Day or something like that. This had obviously huge bipartisan support. This is something that lawmakers of both parties are thinking, yeah, we got to do something about this?
Right, absolutely. I was a little surprised that the Senate chose to send it back to the Finance Committee, but that doesn't mean it's dead. It just means that it's going to take a little bit more time. There have been a number of changes to the bill since it was first proposed in October. A lot of give and take back and forth before they finally came up with what they think is the best solution.
Talking to Shireen Seward, looking at wrongfully convicted people here in Wisconsin, exonerees, and how much the state compensates them when they get out of prison. The current cap, $5,000 a year, would go up to $50,000 a year if this ended up passing. So, Shireen, you've talked to people who've been in this situation. How much of a difference would this change have made for them when they got out of prison?
Oh, it's enormous. I mean, people who commit crimes and get out of prison are entitled to job training. They get health care. They get other services that help transition them into the community. But people who are innocent don't get any of that. So these people spend years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. Then they get out, and they don't even get the same services as somebody who's guilty. I mean, it's just incredibly difficult for these people to get on with their lives. They have missed so many years of working. They have this gap in their employment that they're going to have to explain to everyone. And they often come into a world that's incredibly different from the one they left.
And those services you mentioned, the job training, the health insurance, that's part of this new legislation too, is that right?
Yes, yes. They would be entitled to health insurance and some transitional services. So it's a much better scenario for them than what we have right now.
So how often does this happen, that someone is exonerated after having been convicted and sent to prison?
Well, in Wisconsin, the number of people exonerated is relatively small when you think of how many people have been convicted of crimes. There have only been 43 over the past 26 years. But altogether, they've spent well over 300 years behind bars, and the cost to taxpayers has been more than $10 million. We've spent a lot of money on this already. It's just incredible. But yes, there have been a number of exonerations in the last year alone.
Yeah, it's not a lot of people, but is there a sense among supporters of this change that the magnitude of the injustice being done means that we have to do something?
Absolutely. I mean, there has been a great deal of discussion about it, and the fact that Wisconsin lags behind the federal standard is very concerning. We have not changed our compensation rate since the late 80s.
Well, one sort of side argument that's come up with this is another provision in this bill that says, hey, you've been exonerated, and if you ask, you can have your records of the case sealed. And that hasn't sat well with some public information, public records advocates. What's the concern there?
Sure. There's two ways of looking at this. You know, from the person who's exonerated, from their point of view, they want that gone. I mean, because anybody can still look up the crime on CCAP and see that there, and they're always going to have to explain it, and there's always going to be that sliver of doubt. But there's another side of that where people believe that sealing those records, it conceals the fact that it happened, and it also conceals the misconduct that might have occurred in the case. So by leaving those records open, it allows for a little bit more reflection, for people to go back and see what went wrong in a case like that.
Yeah, this comes as the nation is watching this Stephen Avery case and the making of a murderer on Netflix. And you know, there's campaigns to try to get the case reviewed or a pardon, things like that. I gather that representatives in the legislature said, no, this was totally unrelated to that. But is that something that you think has the public thinking about prosecutorial misconduct, possible wrongful convictions here in the state?
Well, I'm certain that it has started a conversation about that, but this legislation first came up quite a few months before that particular documentary was released. So there isn't that definite cause and effect, but it certainly has increased the volume of the conversation about this issue.
Now, as you mentioned, you were somewhat surprised or not sure what to make of the Senate referring this to the Joint Finance Committee. I know we don't know what's going on behind closed doors or in people's minds, but would you be surprised if this does not get passed, maybe with some minor revisions, by the end of this session?
I will be surprised if it doesn't pass at some point. Obviously, somebody's got some questions about it, and I don't know what happened today in that particular session. But I will be surprised, given the widespread support of this bill, if it doesn't pass at some point this year.
And are you going to go back and contact some of the exonerees you've interviewed before and see what they think about this if it does come to pass?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because this could be potentially life-changing for many of them.
And how did this come about, do you think? Was there, and obviously this is a small group, not a huge lobbying power here, but were a lot of people active on this, or is this just something that came to the right legislator's eye and got going?
I think it's been something that's been tossed around for a couple of years, but you know, really not seriously tackled until probably the last few months. When that particular story that published in July about a man who spent nearly two decades in prison for a crime he didn't commit, there were a number of scathing editorials that were written after that. And I don't know, but I suspect that did catch the eye of some in the legislature who maybe took a closer look at this issue.
Well, Shereen, thanks for checking back in with us on this issue.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Shereen Seward, currently news editor of the City Pages in Wausau. She's reported on compensation for wrongfully convicted inmates, exonerees, with Gannett, Wisconsin Media's investigative team. She talked to us about a bill aimed at increasing compensation for people who have been wrongly convicted of crimes that passed the Assembly unanimously. It was sent to the Joint Finance Committee today by the State Senate. So we'll be watching that one and see how it progresses. Coming up, we'll have the latest in our Wisconsin Life series looking at literacy in the state. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll learn about programs being developed to aid in technological literacy here in Wisconsin. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and all this week, our look at literacy here in the state. Ruth began working with her tutor, Bonnie, nearly a year ago. Once a week, the two meet at the Oshkosh Public Library. With Bonnie's help, Ruth hopes to increase her reading skills and earn her GED.
I was recently retired and decided I needed to do something constructive with my time. And I saw in the paper where they were needing volunteers, so I contacted them. I went through the training that you need to go through. I remember I still have the email that Danielle sent me and said, I have a learner for you that I think you would like to work with, and her name is Ruth.
First, when I got here, I had problems of reading, understanding the questions. That person said, well, I know some people up here that could help you with it. So I came up here.
Ruth is my first person that I tutored with, and I think Ruth was working towards her GED initially. That's what brought her to those services. And we've been together since that time.
We read every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday for about an hour.
Sometimes she will help me go over words and solving it out. Because I do have some big words right now that I got a book I'm reading.
But she does really well. We're working on breaking them apart, sounding them out. Ruth is not a child, so I'm not going to teach Ruth like a child. Ruth is very committed to this. She never misses, and she has made such huge progress this last year. It's amazing. The Ruth that I first met was not this Ruth. You were very quiet, and you did not make eye contact. You didn't smile, and now it's like she's just gotten that self-confidence, and she shines when she's here.
I never had people do this before. I usually try to depend on myself, and I love working with her. She's a very sweet lady, but she's been doing a lot of things for me that I don't expect her to do. I mean, she's like my sister, but she's not. She goes out for me, and I love her for that. I mean, she's a great lady.
Make me cry, Ruth. Don't make me cry this morning.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It's the truth. I mean, I'd go out and jump for celebration if I passed the test. You did it. Now go out there and buy screen the whole world. I did it. That would make me feel so happy and proud. That's my goal right now.
We'll work on that then.
Ruth is trying to improve her reading and earn her GED with the help of her tutor, Bonnie. They shared their story as part of this week's look at literacy in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info and more stories, visit wisconsinlife.org. Continuing our conversation now about literacy, if you know how to use a computer, you surf the internet, maybe every day, you might not think about how difficult it might be for some people to learn how to use technology that comes easily as part of the routine for you. For a number of people, having to take, say, the GED online or start a social media profile, even send an email, can be a daunting task. Joining us now to talk about developing programs that help teach people how to use technology, we have Bonnie Tomlin, different Bonnie, by the way, than in that story. She's a multimedia developer at Fox Valley Technical College. Bonnie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why is tech literacy, these basic computer skills, so important?
Well, it's important because all of our careers are moving in this way that you need to be computer literate to obtain a decent job and have a decent career.
And, yeah, I think about a lot of jobs out there, and so many of them and more demand at least that basic level of computer competency, don't they?
Yes, they definitely do.
And we're not talking about, you know, a high-tech programming language. You're looking at basic computer skills, which I think is actually the name of your program. What kind of skills are we talking about here?
Well, the course starts out really basic, starting from all of the hardware that you'll need to know, using the mouse, using a keyboard, identifying a CPU and a monitor, and then we build from there. We add in the operating system and word processing skills and all the way up to social media.
Yeah, and these are things, again, that people who use computers all the time probably take for granted, and maybe like basic reading literacy. It's something that people might be embarrassed if they're in a situation to say, yeah, I don't know how to do that. I don't even know how to turn that thing on.
Exactly.
So let's talk through your program. You say it goes step by step. How did you assess what the most important skills were going to be?
Well, this was a joint program from all of the technical colleges. They got together and determined what skills were really required to bring this level of user up to what would be required in the job environment today.
And who was your target audience? Who did you have in mind as you're developing this program?
Well, it's basically anybody that needs these skills, but specifically we were looking at dislocated workers, possibly veterans that may be leaving the military and then going into the job force, or individuals that are re-entering the workforce.
So take us to step one. This is kind of a programmed instruction where you start, as you said, with the basics and move on to more advanced things. What would the first lesson look like for that person? Say they've been laid off from a factory job. They're using a computer for the first time.
Sure. Well, you can use these in any order, but the one that we identified as going first would be using computing devices. The first learning activity is called use the mouse, and then identify computer devices would be the second. And the third in that module would be operate a computer and printer. And then that module ends with a test. So you're making sure that you know that you're understanding the material before you move forward.
If somebody's out there listening saying, yeah, that's me or a family member, I need to do this, where would they actually go? I mean, I assume you don't start off online because that presupposes knowing how to get there.
Well, you can actually start online. If you go to www.wisc-online.com, and that's WISC-online.com. And then you would go ahead and just click on that. So you may need some help. Mm-hmm. And if you do need help, you can go to the Workforce Development Centers, and they would be able to help you, as well as any of the technical colleges.
Okay, so tech colleges and workforce centers can help people at least get started with the program.
Right.
We're talking about technological literacy with Bonnie Tomlin. She's a multimedia developer at Fox Valley Technical College. She's been working on this new tech literacy series, really, of programs to help people, often dislocated workers, maybe veterans, start from the basics with computer skills and work up to things that they would need on a lot of job sites. So let's get a little more advanced, Bonnie. What kind of programs are you helping people get started on via these programs?
I'm sorry, what kind of program?
What kind of software, yeah?
Well, word processing software, so Microsoft Word, email, Outlook or Hotmail email typically, as well as Outlook, as well as social media. If you need to know about Facebook or LinkedIn, is pretty common now for finding job opportunities. And then also making sure that you're secure when you are actually on the computer and using your devices.
Now, what have you heard from educators who have used the programs you've developed?
We've heard great things. I've talked to the adult basic education instructors personally, and they said that this course really hits the mark. I do have a quote from one of the employment and training specialists from Workforce Development, if you're interested.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, she says, after previewing the basic skills computer course, I found the lessons and course material to be right on the mark and at a pace that would not overwhelm a new or inexperienced computer user. And she goes on to say, this program helps solve a significant long-term workforce training need by helping job seekers increase their computer skills.
So how long has this basic computer skills series been in action?
Well, we had the first 6 modules completed by September of last year, and then we finished 3 more modules by the end of the year, by December of 2015.
And do we know how many people have gotten started, have been using these so far?
So I have numbers just from January 1st through February 11th of this year, so about 6 weeks, and it's over 6,000 users.
Really? Quite a few. So what's next? What modules are going to be adding in the future? How widespread are we going to see these things go?
At this point, I'm not sure. That would probably be somebody above my level thinking about that and seeing where we need to add the more information in.
And then what are your hopes for the people who are using this program? What are you hoping they get out of the work you put into it?
Well, I'm hoping they find a great job in a field that they're really interested in, and this computer technology has given them a leg up to get there.
All right. Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for telling us about the program.
Thank you.
That's Bonnie Tomlin. She's a multimedia developer at Fox Valley Technical College. We've been talking about programs that she developed that help people gain valuable technical skills that might help them get a job, as she says. This interview is part of a week-long Wisconsin Life series, by the way, focusing on literacy here in Wisconsin. Tune into Morning Edition at 6:30 and 8:30 in the morning, and Central Time, that's us, 4:15 each day this week for more stories and interviews. You can also listen to archived segments at WPR.org by searching Literacy Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk about yesterday's primary election results. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's election results from yesterday's primaries. First, Milwaukee-based WPR reporter Chuck Quernbach observed a bus tour today that was taking an on-the-ground look at the Waukesha proposal to divert water from Lake Michigan, as well as an informational session led by the state DNR. He joins us now to bring us up to speed. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, tell us about this bus tour. It's looking at this idea of diverting water from Lake Michigan for use by Waukesha. Who is part of this tour?
Sure. It's representatives from the 8 Great Lakes states and 2 Canadian provinces that border the Great Lakes. They were on this bus that toured portions of Waukesha, Milwaukee counties that were key to the water diversion. Journalists and other interested parties followed behind in their caravan of vehicles, but the bus tour stopped at several locations, and regional compact commission members ask questions of Waukesha water officials and others.
So these out-of-state people get some say over what happens in Waukesha. This all goes back to this Great Lakes Compact, is that right?
Right, that's right. And Waukesha's proposal, again, is to take water from Lake Michigan, buying it from the city of Oak Creek, piping it 15, 17 miles west to Waukesha, using it in the community, treating the wastewater and sending it back via pipe to the Root River in the Milwaukee suburb of Franklin. Water would then flow back into Lake Michigan through the city of Racine. We stopped, the bus stopped this morning at several locations, including the near the intake pipe along Lake Michigan in Oak Creek, also where the discharge water would go back into the Root River in Franklin, and then also a little bit more extensively at Waukesha's wastewater treatment plant, where they say they're making a large investment, $70 million or so in upgrades, all suggesting that, yes, they could treat this wastewater and send it back to the Root River with no problem.
As I understand it, to get approved under the Great Lakes Compact to divert water, Waukesha would have to commit to successfully, I guess, putting as much water back into the lake as they take out. Is that right?
Right, and I think that seems to be an accepted accepted plan from all sides. No one seems to be questioning that Waukesha would really send back as much water. It's the question what came up today, especially in an afternoon information session for this regional compact representatives. These are representatives of various states and provinces. They asked several questions about Waukesha's extended service area. In other words, there are two or three smaller communities outside the city of Waukesha that would also get water. Several questions were raised about that because there's been some controversy over, well, is it just Waukesha that needs water, or what about these smaller communities? What about economic growth in these smaller communities, and is this really about just finding a cleaner source of drinking water, or is it about growth? And one commission member said sprawl.
And this is all happening because Waukesha's main water supply now has levels of radium. I guess there's a court order that they have to get away from that supply within a couple of years. So that community has a lot at stake here.
Well, that's true, and supposedly the deadline is 2018. Deadlines get changed, I suppose, too, with the right political pressure, but right now everybody's operating on the 2018. Some environmental groups suggest that Waukesha would do better by expanding its well system, making more use of local wells and not bringing in lake water. Waukesha says no, that would, and the Wisconsin DNR, which is given this basic thumbs up to Waukesha's proposal, of course, that's why we're at these Midwest-level hearings at this point, that the Waukesha and the DNR say, no, if you do more well water use, that would not necessarily solve the problem. It might cause surface problems, especially for area wetlands.
And there's a public hearing tomorrow afternoon, I think. Who's going to be collecting that input? Who can speak there?
Well, again, this is regional body. The regional body and compact council will be hearing testimony from the public. Quite a big crowd is expected. In some of the other communities, Michigan has had a hearing, and environmental groups railed against the proposal. We expect testimony from both sides, really. Tomorrow, there's some Waukesha residents that were here today at Carroll University expressing support to reporters about the proposal, but not getting a formal chance to speak until tomorrow.
And do we have a timeline on when a decision is expected from the Great Lakes states and provinces on whether this can move ahead?
Well, supposedly these representatives, after the meetings end Thursday, will go back to their states and talk and deliberate and talk with their governors and so on. And we may have a ruling by the various governors by May, mid-May.
We'll keep watching this with you, Chuck. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR's Milwaukee-based reporter Chuck Quernbach giving us the latest on the proposal to divert water from Lake Michigan to Waukesha. He took part in a bus tour and informational session earlier today. Now, it was primary election day in Wisconsin yesterday. Voters weighed in on the Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice primary and other countywide and local races as well. Daniel Bice joins us to talk about the winners and losers from yesterday's election. He's the Watchdog columnist, and he wrote about this for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's start with voter turnout, Dan. First, statewide election, to use the new voter ID law, first one in quite a while. There are questions about what turnout would be like, especially in a low turnout election, usually like this one. What did we see happen?
Well, actually, the turnout was much better than people expected. Political insiders had told me that they were expecting about 30 to 35,000 people to vote in Milwaukee, and it turned out to be twice that number. And statewide, the numbers were equally impressive. In 2013, the voter turnout was about 360,000, and yesterday it was over 560,000. So the voter ID didn't appear to suppress votes in this race, but the real test will come in April and in November when you have high turnout races in Wisconsin.
Yeah, this is not one of your marquee elections here. Turnout still wasn't huge, but do you think anything about the race this time, either at the state level or with those big Milwaukee County races, drove people to the polls?
It looks like the turnout in the city was impressive. There was one group that was formed to try to get out the vote in the African American community. I'm guessing that was a factor. You also had the Supreme Court race, but usually Supreme Court races don't draw as many people as this. So it's an interesting phenomenon. I think you're right that in Southeast Wisconsin, the numbers were higher than usual. But I think there probably was people, there were people coming out to vote for and against Rebecca Bradley in the Supreme Court race. So, I mean, those were probably the two major factors.
Now let's look at that Supreme Court race now. Rebecca Bradley, as you mentioned, Joanne Kloppenburg came out as the winners there. They're going to face off in April. What did you make of the results? They're pretty close between the two of them.
Yeah, it was 45% to 43%. And I didn't make either one of those candidates one of my winners or losers. I instead made Governor Scott Walker a loser in this because, you know, he's joined at the hip with Rebecca Bradley. He appointed her to the Circuit Court, to the Appeals Court, and now to the Supreme Court. You know, her rapid rise is a direct result of his efforts. And she's, even though she's not used him in any of the campaign material. So I think the race in April will definitely be a referendum on Walker, who's, you know, about as unpopular as he's ever been in the state. So she had a lot of things going for her. Her side outspent the other two candidates by what I'm told is 6-to-1 ratio. And she had a big push on talk radio in southeastern Wisconsin in the last week and a half. And still she ends up winning by only 2 percentage points. And many of the people looking at this race will say Joe Donald, the third candidate, his support will probably go to Kloppenburg. So that's an interesting factor in there as well. The one thing that you can't gauge is what impact the Republican and Democratic presidential primary will have on this race. All of those candidates will be trying to turn out the votes, and it'll be interesting to see if the Republicans get out more votes for Bradley or Democrats get out more votes for Kloppenburg.
Yeah, and this is one of those nonpartisan races where you really want to throw quotes around that. I think the candidates, of course, won't say, yeah, I'm the conservative candidate, yeah, I'm the liberal candidate, but everybody else in the state pretty much knows this, right?
Right. I mean, and there's no reason to say that to put quotes around Republicans getting out the vote for Bradley, because they are Republicans who will be getting out the votes for Bradley, and they will be Democrats getting out the vote for Kloppenburg. It's the candidates that you have to put the quotes around, because both of them are running as nonpartisan candidates.
And we've seen some really expensive Supreme Court races here in Wisconsin in the past. I wonder, this one, the what is generally held to be the conservative faction or group on the state Supreme Court already has a majority. This race isn't going to change that. It could give them a stronger majority. So given that it's not a swing vote on the court, do you think we're going to see that much outside money as we have in some cases in the past?
Well, you know, the money so far has come in on the right. I think what you saw in the past week might illustrate the need for this seat for conservatives. There was a Supreme Court case on warrantless searches. The vote was actually 4-3. It was the first time that Bradley had participated in a case. One of the so-called conservatives, David Prosser, voted with the liberals, making it 3-3 without her support. So, you know, Prosser has an independent streak, and if they get this fifth vote, then it locks up the conservative position. On the other hand, this 45-43% result, I think, has got to embolden a number of liberals who probably weren't planning to participate in this race financially or otherwise, and it's got to convince them that maybe this is a winnable seat.
We're talking to Daniel Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the winners and losers in yesterday's primary elections in Wisconsin. We're going to visit Milwaukee and Milwaukee County in just a few moments, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you make of the election results statewide or in your area? Did you vote in yesterday's election? Did you use voter ID for the first time? How'd it go at your polling station? Which Supreme Court candidate are you backing? And did you have a local race that was important to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our discussion now about yesterday's primary election results with Daniel Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your experience like yesterday at the polls? Did you go to the polls? How did voter ID change things at your polling station? And who did you vote for? What candidates are you backing? What races are you watching? Call 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dan, we'll visit Milwaukee in just a minute, but we've got a couple callers callers talk about turnout and voter ID. Sure. I want to start with Cindy in Fox City. Cindy, hi.
Hello.
Or in the Fox Cities, I should say. Cindy, hi.
Fox Cities. Yes, I actually ran for a county supervisor position here in Appleton, one of our local districts, and we did have a primary. And we are in a district that has well over 2,000 addresses, and we had 165 people show up to vote, which is way less than 10%. So were any of us winners? Not really.
Interesting. Cindy, thanks a lot for sharing that. So there are going to be places that see low voter turnout, Dan, and that has people worried about our election system.
Sure. I mean, there are going to be places like that, but the fact is, in general, Wisconsin voters love to vote. We traditionally outpace the rest of the country, and some of the highest turnouts are in the counties right around Milwaukee. So, yes, there will be exceptions, but overall, the numbers were much stronger than expected yesterday.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Katie now in Clinton. Katie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to say I used the ID yesterday for the first time, and it went perfectly. It was very smooth. They just checked my picture and my address against the book. I signed the book, got my ballot, and voted, and it was absolutely flawless. There was an elderly woman in front of me that was just praising the whole thing. She went through just flawless. My 19-year-old voted for the very first time, had to go into the polling place and registered and show his ID, and he voted for the first time, and it was wonderful.
Katie, thanks a lot for sharing that. We've heard on Facebook from at least one listener saw some confusion there. But, Dan, generally some good reviews, it sounds like, on voter ID. Christian Snyder, a conservative writer at your paper, who has supported voter ID all along, I think, said, hey, this vindicates it. What kind of things are we hearing?
I don't think it vindicates it. The true test is in April and again in November, as I said, because this is a relatively low turnout election. I don't know what it was like for you, but when I went to go vote, there was only one person in line in front of me, so it was very easy. I could show them the ID and I moved on. But if you've got a line of 100 people there, it could slow things down. So I think it was a good early review for it, but I don't think you could say that it vindicated voter ID yet.
And it was kind of a dry run for the higher turnout elections.
Sure. I mean, April's going to be incredible. Each of these presidential candidates will be trying to turn out the vote. I expect many, many more people to vote in April.
Talking to Daniel Bice about yesterday's primary elections. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. Races you're watching, how the polls went where you are. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Daniel, I want to check in on Milwaukee City and County. Now, these are things that people in the state should maybe watch. You've got a mayor who is twice a candidate for governor. You've got a county executive who people
three
have talked
times.
About. Right, yeah. Oh, three times, yeah.
Three times, yeah, back in 2002 in addition to 10.
Forgot that
12.
One, yeah. You've got a county executive who people said might run for governor, and, of course, the current governor, that was his previous gig. So let's start with the race for mayor there. Tom Barrett, he's crushed it in a lot of races, big wins. How did he come out yesterday?
He ended up with 46% of the vote. He finished first. Second place was Alderman Bob Donovan, a conservative from the city's south side. He got 33% of the vote. And then there was a third candidate. There were four candidates overall, but a third major candidate, Alderman Joe Davis, who ended up with slightly less than 20% of the vote. So 46%. Probably not as strong as they want. You would like as an incumbent to top 50% in a primary. He did not. Still, 13 percentage points is considered a landslide in most places. But, you know, in his last two reelection bids, Mayor Barrett's top 70%. And that's going to be very hard for him to do with the crime problems that's going on in Milwaukee right now. But, again, and I've made mention of this a couple of times, the Democratic presidential campaigns will be coming in and trying to turn out the vote in the city, and that's got to favor him over Donovan, who is a conservative.
So he's maybe, we could speculate, not breaking a huge sweat over yesterday's results.
I think it's not as strong as they would like. You would like to be over 50 percentage points, but I think they're feeling somewhat comfortable going into the general election. They're much more comfortable than the county executive is today.
That's right. Now, we've got an incumbent county executive there. He's got personal money to spend, and he spent some. How did that one turn out?
The incumbent is Chris Abele, who has fashioned himself as a moderate Democrat, someone who's liberal on social issues, conservative on economic issues. His father's a billionaire, and he himself is a multimillionaire. He's cruised through his last two reelection bids, and now he is facing against Chris Larson, a state senator who was once the Senate Majority Leader. And Abele started spending heavily in October, spent more than $1 million on TV and direct mail over the last few months, and he ended up finishing second, which was a surprising and stunning result. Larson ended up with 45% of the race, even though there's been a lot of turmoil with his campaign, and he's severely underfunded. Abele ended up with 44% of the votes. It's only 700 votes difference between the two, but I don't know of anyone outside of Abele's pollster who saw this coming.
And this is going to be a race to watch then. That close, that much maybe money on the table, and kind of a internal squabble, maybe a tough decision for some Democrats in the county.
Sure. Larson's running as a traditional liberal Democrat. The question to me is, how much money is Abele going to spend to hang on to the seat? And I was talking with people close to the Abele campaign today, and I said, do you think it's fair for me to say that he'll spend at least $5 million on this race now? And I was told that estimate is low.
Wow.
That he is, as one person said, that he will spend what it takes to win. There's no number on that. The figure now being tossed around is maybe $7 to $8 million on this race. And the big thing that's going to change here is there was a lot of negative advertising toward Abele, but none against Larson. And I expect the Abele campaign to go very negative against Larson to try to drive up his negatives in the next 2 months.
I want to bring on a couple more callers, talk about their voting experiences. We've got Alex with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi. I voted yesterday at a place I've been going to for 13 years. I knew every one of the workers well, and I had to pull out my ID. It was offensive and embarrassing and awkward. One of the watchers there's elderly mother had misplaced her ID, so she could not vote. This is an attempt by these Republicans to get power and nothing more. It's offensive and genders anger, and I can't wait for them to get out this fall.
Alex, thanks a lot for the call. Do you think, Dan, a lot of people, Democrats for the most part, are sharing that feeling of anger having had to show ID yesterday?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty strong reaction to having to show an ID, but I understand the difficulty for people who don't drive. Surely, I mean, this is clearly a Republican initiative. There's been a lot of debate about whether it's needed or not. When I said that it worked well, overall, in terms of not suppressing the vote, I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree with voter ID in general, but I'm sure there were some Democrats in Madison, Milwaukee, who were offended that they had to show their ID to vote at a polling place, just like that gentleman who voted at the same place for many years.
And we'll bring on next Mary in New Berlin. Mary, hi.
Hi. I was at a polling place yesterday where it was very cumbersome. All seven districts were in one location, which gave the feel of a large number of voters. It was cumbersome, and it was slow, and there were lines.
Mary, thanks for that call. And that's what probably some people are worried about, as you say, Dan, come April, when there's going to be a lot more people at the polls.
Sure. And I'm guessing, you know, for it to work, they're going to have to be more poll workers than what we saw yesterday. So as you said, this is probably a dry run. The areas that had difficulties will have time to adjust. And she mentioned New Berlin. In Waukesha County, there were a number of problems, including the fact that the clerk for Waukesha County underestimated the number of people who were going to vote, and so they had problems with ballots as well. So Waukesha County has had problems for the last 5 or 6 years on many fronts with their elections.
Briefly, Dan, as we wrap up, one big question is, how many in this presidential primary, how many candidates are going to be left by the time they come to Wisconsin? Do you think that's going to have an impact on turnout if Clinton wins at all by then? Probably not going to happen. Or if a lot of Republicans drop out by then?
I think we can be pretty sure that you know, what we have in front of us is Nevada and South Carolina, and then Super Tuesday, and then not much until our election. So I think we're pretty safe in saying that the Democratic primary is not going to be resolved. And, you know, the consolidation of candidates on the Republican side that many people predicted has just not happened. You have four candidates in Cruz, Rubio, Bush, and Kasich who continue to poll between 8% and 20%. And, you know, so Trump continues to be in this race. So I think both presidential contests are going to be active and competitive in April.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thanks.
That's Daniel Bice, watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about yesterday's primary election results. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll look at what's ahead for the South Carolina Republican primary and the Nevada Democratic caucus. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.